Less risky chips at KubeCon, FCC bumps broadband, Rancher rounds up AI containers, Sios not kidding around with HA, soft iron goes hyper, AMD and Intel are out in China, and we catch up on all the NVIDIA news in this week's episode of the Gestalt IT Rundown. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the March 27th episode of the Gestalt IT Rundown. My name is Tom Hollingsworth, and I'm a lumberjack, and I'm okay. Joining me is my co-host who sleeps all night and works all day, Mr. Stephen Foskett. Stephen, welcome to the show.
I don't know what to say to that. Thanks. I guess you fixed my little red wagon here on National Little Red Wagon Day.
Well, I'm glad because I heard that the backseat's broken and the axle's dragging. But what's not dragging this week is all of the news stories that we have coming out. It's going to be a jam-packed episode because we have a lot of things to cover, both in the news and also some more news coming out of NVIDIA GTC, which we will get to after we cover some of the big top stories that were coming out, because we wanted to start off by talking about KubeCon and Scaleway. They showed off some of their new RISC-V offerings during KubeCon 2024 last week in Paris. The company is providing servers at around 16 euros a month, and it includes a modest TH1520 RISC-V CPU with 16 gigabytes of RAM and 128 gigabytes of storage. The idea is that they're trying to provide a way for new entrants into the market to be able to deploy RISC-V without the need to kind of put the kit together themselves and try to figure out how all the parts are going to be working together. Since this was at KubeCon, of course, you can be assured that it is going to run containers just fine and be able to use your favorite workloads. Stephen, is deploying RISC-V for containers going to be something we should expect to see more of in the future? Or is this Scaleway doing a little bit of wish fulfillment?
No, I think that there's definitely going to be more and more RISC-V, especially in the cloud, in the future. This is kind of an interesting aspect here. So, there's a whole bunch of things to unpack here. So first off, Scaleway is a French cloud provider, but they're showing off a hardware kit that's based on a Chinese RISC-V processor developed by Alibaba and selling it per month in the cloud. So I think a lot of our listeners might be scratching their heads and saying, what even is this thing? Well, essentially, this is a Raspberry Pi as a service based on RISC-V that you can start experimenting with. I don't think it's really intended to go into production. I don't think that's the goal here. I think the goal here is basically to say, if you're interested in an alternative to x86 and ARM, if you're interested in deploying modern applications and Kubernetes on a new platform like RISC-V, if you're interested in getting out in front of that wave, because that wave is coming, as we are going to talk about more and more in this episode and future episodes of the Rundown, then this is a good way to get started. I love the idea. Basically, for 15 euros 99 per month, you get a server. It's a RISC-V server. It exists in the cloud. It's got a decent amount of RAM. It's got a decent amount of storage, enough to get started with, enough to get to start playing around with, enough to see just how well RISC-V CPUs today can stand up to cloud-native workloads. Over time, I think that these things, because of their economies and because especially in terms of power, I think these things are going to be more and more widespread. I think we're going to see more and more microservices being deployed on RISC-V. I could definitely see functions as a service being deployed here. And I think it's just a really nice way to get out ahead of that and take a look at this technology. So kudos to Scaleway. Kudos to all the hackers at KubeCon who saw this little device and said, you know what, I think I'm going to give that a try. And I'll see you in a couple of years when we're ready to actually deploy this stuff in earnest. The FCC has changed their requirements for what constitutes a broadband connection here in the U.S. The guidelines now state that a connection must be 100 megabits down and 20 megabits up in order to be considered broadband by the FCC. The old rules had 25 down and 3 up as the minimum, which pretty much mapped to terrible DSL, which was available in lots of places, including right here in beautiful Hudson, Ohio, until recently. These changes follow a 2021 congressional report that stated that anyone without access to faster speeds was considered underserved by ISPs. The FCC noted that most providers are offering at least 100 megabits down today, as many applications need that kind of bandwidth, but some still aren't, and some, well, they're fudging their numbers. Tom, what's your assessment of this impact?
I think it's interesting because, like you said, a lot of ISPs have been saying, well, we offer at least 100 megabits down, so I don't know why you can't increase that minimum. Have you tried to use 25 megabit down internet recently? I haven't, because I would go crazy. Like, think about when your cell phone is stuttering because an application is taking, you know, just a couple of extra seconds to load. You're like, you know, banging on it like a, like the monkey at the beginning of 2001 A Space Odyssey, because my tool doesn't work. But the thing is, there's so many other components that go into this. It's more than just the downstream. It's the application experience. And a lot of applications just assume that you have an ultra fast connection nowadays. The other thing, you kind of alluded to it in your introduction, Stephen, is this idea that the reason why those numbers were plucked out of thin air, you know, back in 2013 was not happenstance. It just happened to be what a DSL connection could provide at the time. Well, what's happened in the last 11 years? The providers have tried to get rid of DSL. They've argued that having access to DSL is a, you know, a burden upon them because the maintenance of those lines is just so unwieldy, and they would rather be able to run fiber into locations, but they don't want to pay for it themselves. So they really need funding from the U.S. federal government to be able to provide these services to rural areas. And oh boy, if you would just pay us, we would bump the internet speed out there to this minimum that you have. Yeah, that's a lot of what this is about, is getting federal funding to increase all of these things. Now, you'll notice that this is just for hardwired dedicated circuits. It leaves out wireless ISPs. They did not get bumped to something close to this. And let's be fair, that's unrealistic for them anyway. But wireless ISPs have actually been a big competitor in the market for these underserved DSL connections, because effectively what they are trying to do is they're trying to displace those crappy old DSL connections where you like have to put the acoustic coupler on your line and cross your fingers and hope there are no sunspots. It's like, hey, as long as there's not like a grove of trees in the way, this wireless ISP will work just fine. Now, the other thing to mention here, of course, is that Starlink doesn't qualify for any of this because their downstream latency is way too high, and they can't promise you that they'll have connectivity if that cluster of satellites isn't in the right spot in the sky right now. So I think that this is just a way to drive competition in the market, to knock out some smaller rural telcos, maybe even to see them absorbed into larger conglomerates like AT&T and Verizon, and get some more funding to get people to maybe get a little bit faster internet so that their applications still take about the same amount of time to load. SUSE is working to ensure that AI and ML workloads are ready to go with their latest container management platform. The latest updates to the Rancher platform are aimed at helping with supply chain security and lifecycle management, but one of the biggest additions is the ability to detect NVIDIA container runtimes and help deploy them more efficiently from the Rancher management interface. The latest updates also include enhanced debugging and integration with popular new AI frameworks. I know that Rancher has been a huge component of the container workspace for a long time, Stephen, and I know that SUSE is really backing this project. How are these integrations with AI and ML workloads going to help Rancher continue on into the future?
Well, I'm very impressed by what SUSE has been doing with Rancher. I will start out by admitting that I'm a big Rancher fan. I have been experimenting with Rancher for many years, and I find it just a wonderful, wonderful environment for deploying microservices and modern applications. I have run Rancher on the infamous Office coffee table cloud cluster, which contact me if you want to see what that's all about. And I have found that it works incredibly well. Also, in my experience with Cloud Field Day, Edge Field Day, and now our new App Dev Field Day, it's become increasingly apparent to me that having certified application stores, basically the Apple approach to app stores, is really a great way to go once you get outside the data center. That, to me, is really what SUSE is doing. So from my perspective, I look at this as sort of one of the reasons that I love my iPhone is because I know that everything in the App Store has been vetted and certified and validated, and it's the right thing. And, I feel comfortable giving an iOS device to somebody who's less technical because they're not likely to load it up with malware and garbage. Well, it's kind of the same thing here, that SUSE has built this beautiful Rancher platform on a scaled down version of Kubernetes. They've built on top of that all sorts of it just works kind of software, whether it is the certified supply chain, the platform as a service, you know, this curated applications that they have, the ease of deployment, the ease of management. All of this really is intended to give you that sort of hands-off comfort in terms of deploying these devices in places and deploying a modern web services platform in places that, well, aren't always that friendly to software deployment. That, to me, is what's going on here. So the edge aspect is really important. The fact that this is built on Kubernetes and the fact that it has an entire supply chain of certified, correct components, well, that should give people a lot of comfort in deploying applications at the edge, especially on Kubernetes. So again, I say that way to go here, SUSE. I've been really enjoying what you're doing, and I can't wait to see more. Sios is working on making HA easier for everyone. As we discussed on a briefing recently, their newest update to Lifekeeper is aimed at applications running on Linux systems. The difference is that Lifekeeper takes care of the complex tasks of building server clusters and monitoring states so that if a member goes down, a switchover is seamless. Lifekeeper is looking to build a universal high availability solution, according to Krista McComber here at Futurum Group. And that shows the fact that and the dashboard can be accessed from anywhere, including a mobile phone. I recently had a chance to talk to Sios about it, and I was pretty enthused about it, as was Krista. Tom, what's your take?
Anyone out there who remembers trying to configure VMware HA in a cluster without the like trappings of all the advanced VMware stuff knows the pain of just trying to get it to work. I remember having to go in and hack host files and VI and all that other stuff, and eventually I made it work, at least in theory. I never actually unplugged anything to test it. And that's why when I saw this, I was super excited because Sios is just like, hey, we'll make it work. But, you know, it's because they're putting all the heavy lifting into making all of those decisions for you. Like they'll configure the systems for you. They have a web interface that does not require you to deploy X Windows or Java on a server. That's a radical shift from the way that people have been doing things for years. Like it's all just taken care of. And there's the high availability thing is critical for, you know, if you're running like a really important infrastructure application, like say medical records or, you know, some kind of like emergency services thing. But more importantly, it's a security thing as well. Think about it like this. If I have someone who launches a DDoS attack against my website because they want to take me down for whatever reason, let's say it's ransomware. If I know that I have a working, validated HA cluster, I can say, well, you go ahead. I can distribute that load across there. But more importantly, I can get alerts as soon as that starts happening and be able to log in and fix things. I don't have to go unearth some, you know, 10-year-old laptop that runs a very specific version of the Java client to log into an outdated web interface. I just pull up my phone. And that's one of the things that they talked about in the announcement is that their kit is built to work on modern devices. Pull up my phone from the alert, you know, log into the system. Oh, yeah, okay, I can see this. I either need to bring more capacity online or I need to start, you know, disallowing connections from these IPs for the time being. I think that it is super simple. And their firewall that is in front of all of this requires two TCP ports. I can't think of any application that's been built in the last 30 years that only requires two TCP ports. So that is a huge win in my eyes. And I think it's something that people really should take a look at. If you are at all concerned about HA and you believe that it's more important than just relying on the cloud to do it for you, definitely take a look at the Sios solution because I think it's going to be something you're going to want to deploy and then hopefully not have to worry about again. SoftIron has announced VM Squared. It's their alternative virtualization platform following Broadcom's acquisition of VMware. The solution is built on SoftIron's hypercloud technology, which we recently saw at Cloud Field Day. VM Squared includes simple deployment, automated scaling, and upgrade paths to private cloud, all aimed at alleviating complexities associated with traditional virtualization solutions. It also offers a VMware migration tool, which pretty much says everything you need to know about SoftIron's plans for where they want to sell this product. Steven, you're very familiar with this solution. What should virtualization admins be looking at as they make the decision as to whether or not to stick on VMware or move to a different alternative?
Yeah, we were very impressed by SoftIron at Cloud Field Day. So back in January, we had SoftIron present their HyperCloud solution, and they announced their new version of HyperCloud. HyperCloud is basically a complete private cloud solution built on, and when I say complete, this is the important differentiator, built on in-house hardware. This thing is really, really complete, all the way from the motherboards up to the management interface. And the idea is that SoftIron is delivering a system, a truly integrated solution that replaces the need to do a lot of the things that IT operations groups and IT infrastructure groups need to do. They don't need to worry about, selecting and procuring servers and storage and figuring out software and configuring it all and making it all work in order to have a true private cloud. SoftIron is not a new company. They've been doing this for a long, long time. This is a very mature solution, which is another thing that the Field Day delegates noted about their HyperCloud solution. And now here they are with a new innovation, and I am pretty impressed by what they're doing. One of the things that the delegates said at Cloud Field Day was, this is tremendous. It would be really great as an alternative to VMware, but I just don't see this as a VMware alternative. Well, that's what VMSquared is. It's a VMware alternative. Essentially, it's taking all of that HyperCloud magic in terms of building a truly integrated, flexible, scalable, dare I say, hyperconverged platform, and basically repackaging that for a VMware user that is concerned about the future with Broadcom. So VMSquared does basically all the things you think that you need from vSphere. It gives you all that stuff on a modern and secure platform. And importantly, it includes a VMware migration tool to help make the transition seamless. Now, I will be the first to admit that the transition is never going to be seamless because there's always challenges moving from one platform to another. But SoftIron is trying to help make it better and trying to help make it more useful. And I applaud them for that. They're also trying to basically refactor this product to make it more appealing. And admittedly, I only looked at it a little bit on their website and so on. But, you know, I can see the appeal as a VMware admin. I could see looking at this thing and saying, yeah, that thing makes sense. And then you mix in the other SoftIron magic, which, as I mentioned, it's all built on a truly integrated hardware platform as well. And you start, well, you might start saying, this is kind of what I'm looking for. And so I really applaud SoftIron for doing this. I'm glad to see companies coming up with alternatives to VMware, whether it's SoftIron or Nutanix or any of these other solutions out there that we're seeing. And yet, I also applaud the VMware company for staying true to their focus and basically doing under Broadcom what they should, which is focusing on their core market. I think that many of the users of VMware would be better served with an alternative product. And I think that VMware and Broadcom would agree to that. Whereas, you look at these companies like SoftIron, I think SoftIron would be happy to raise their hands and say, you know what? Yeah, you're better for our platform. And here it is. So all in all, I think it's good for the market to see solutions like this out there. And, I think you should take a look at SoftIron. Chinese authorities this week began enforcing new guidelines on the chips that are allowed to be used in government servers and desktops. The new rules do not allow for chips from companies like Intel and AMD to be used. It also disallows the use of Microsoft Windows as an operating system. Instead, officials are directed to purchase safe and reliable alternatives of Chinese origin. These rules were first proposed back in December, and they're seen as a response to the continued U.S. embargo on advanced semiconductors in China. This, of course, is it rhymes with everything we've been hearing from the U.S. government as well. Sounds like quite a bit of a trade war brewing here, Tom.
I would totally agree. I mean, there's a lot of shade being thrown back and forth between these two giants of industry, if I can quote the great Greek Dionysus, then we will fight in the shade. Because basically what China is doing is they're pushing back and saying, well, if you're going to claim that you are not going to let us use any advanced semiconductor manufacturing because we could use it for military operations and use it to spy on your country, then we're just going to say that your stuff is filled with the same stuff anyway, and you can't use it over here. And boy, isn't it kind of ironic that we just happen to have things that work very similarly or almost identically to the things that you were going to sell us, and we'll just use them instead. Now, as a point of national pride, I can totally understand why the Chinese are wanting to do this. Why would you go buy something from somebody overseas that we made here, probably, and you're just going to ship it over there to buy it from them and ship it right back? It may not have even left the dock. We'll just go get the container. But more importantly, what they're effectively saying is you're going to have to come up with a better reason than insecure or spying or things like that. Ultimately, I think what will happen in this is that there will have to be some kind of an agreement that gets hashed out, because what will happen in the future is that both of these countries will eventually lock each other out of their markets, and that will create a bigger global problem. I know that Intel has been working very hard to leverage CHIPS Act funding to build foundries here in the U.S., and that's going to push the Chinese to figure out how they can consume what they're producing in their foundries. And that could boil over into larger geopolitical consequences for certain contested areas in the Chinese sphere of influence. I won't go into much more detail than that, but you can figure it out. I don't think that's going to be a primary driver there, but I think that if you've got a bunch of production coming online in the US and a bunch of slack production in China that isn't being taken up by people inside of China, I think you could see this being pushed even further, because like you said, right now it's just a mandate for government systems. I could see this very easily becoming a mandate for everyone in China. Like, could you imagine what would happen if Alibaba was suddenly mandated to only use Chinese hardware and software in all of their applications? Well, I know what it would look like, and it would not look good for the bottom line of Microsoft or AMD or Intel. We wanted to take a little bit of a closer look this week at some of the news from NVIDIA GTC. Now, before you pause and check which episode you're watching, yes, we did cover NVIDIA GTC last week because it was a huge story, both on our rundown, but in the tech industry in general. There's no denying that NVIDIA is the company to beat when it comes to AI and HPC technologies, and it has the entire industry on its toes. Every company in tech is emphasizing partnerships or joint offerings with NVIDIA. However, there has been some reaction to companies who have aligned themselves to be against NVIDIA in these markets. Let's start with the partners. According to Futurum Intelligence, the majority of companies are looking to deploy AI and are likely to switch vendors in the next year. And that has a lot of companies rushing to the market with integrated NVIDIA stacks, including Pure Storage, Lenovo, and Weka. Steven, let's kind of run down what some of these are, and I want to get your take on it, because as the host of Utilizing AI, you are more familiar with this than anybody.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. And also, these are, of course, companies that we're very familiar with. Let's not pretend that this is all of it, of course. Literally every company in the industry announced this stuff, including many of the things that we announced or covered last week on the rundown. So I would love to mention that, you know, we talked about Vast Data, we talked about Supermicro. Many, many different companies are deploying integrated stacks for NVIDIA. And let's not forget the video of Jensen Huang in the Dell booth proclaiming his love for Dell's integrated solutions as well. But now let's take a look at some of the other announcements. NVIDIA is willing to work with anybody in the industry, as a market leader should, and Pure Storage is right there. According to Futurum Intelligence, what we're seeing is companies eager to find an alternative that better fits the needs of their particular AI applications. And in the case of each of these storage companies, as we talked about with Vast, as we're going to be talking about with Weka, and NetApp and Pure, all of these companies are rushing to position themselves appropriately in the market so that they can be the leader in one area or another. Now, Pure's positioning is, I think, a very interesting one. Essentially, they have come up with a new reference architecture for AI built on NVIDIA, of course, with the DGX certification, but also, you know, now they're recently have certified for OVX, which is another level of storage server certification. Pure is talking a lot about what's called RAG, R-A-G, Retrieval Automated Generation. Now, this is important, so stick with me here. What RAG means is, well, you know how everybody's all upset about the hallucinations from generative AI? In other words, you ask generative AI a question and it will confidently answer, even if it doesn't have an answer, and it'll just make something up. Well, retrieval augmented generation, or RAG, is an attempt to stop that from happening. Essentially, what you do is you equip that generative AI model with the ability to go look it up. You know, it's like your teacher told you when you were in elementary school. Look it up in the encyclopedia. Look it up in the library. Look it up on, I guess, Wikipedia nowadays. You know, find out what the answer is and then come back and tell me. And that's what RAG is all about. Essentially, as the generative AI applications are processing and coming up with answers, they'll be able to go out and look in structured data sets. That's what we heard about from Click at AI Field Day. That is certainly what Pure is trying to build here too, because Pure, of course, has both general purpose storage systems and special purpose object storage systems that scale out as well. Pure also, of course, has the Portworx range, which includes true data platforms, not just storage. And all of this could theoretically be used to feed new AI applications in a new way. So I have to say that Pure has done a pretty good job here of connecting their solutions into something that is appropriate for a specific part of the AI market, and you know, hopefully would be compelling even in the light of the competing solutions from lots of other storage systems. Now, another briefing that I had prior to GTC was related to Lenovo's hybrid AI. As I've said before on the rundown, Lenovo is a supply chain superhero. Essentially, this is a company that can get kit to market. And Lenovo now has a suite of hybrid AI solutions that they showed at GTC that are focused on, well, basically what you think you would need. I need a server. It needs to have the things in it. It needs to have, you know, all the memory and store, everything. I just need the thing. Can you get me the thing? Lenovo's answer is yes. Yes, we can get you the thing. And not only that, we'll get you the thing, thanks to our professional services and AI advisory, we'll get you the thing that matches your needs. This is seemingly simple, but actually very hard to deliver in reality. They've got these enterprise AI servers in their ThinkSystem line. They include NVIDIA's HGX GPUs in them. And Lenovo is basically ready to start shipping those, ready to start delivering those to customers to meet their needs. They're also looking ahead to delivering the Blackwell systems when the superchips are available, including complete kits with liquid cooling and, you know, rack scale architecture, all that stuff. Lenovo is saying, yes, we will be there. We will be ready to do this. And, you know, it's really no surprise, but also it's kind of nice to see. Now, the third thing I'm going to talk about here is Weka, another company that we've seen at Field Day in the past. Weka has a really tremendous scalable storage solution. They've been making a lot of wins on AI as well, simply because of the way that their system scales. They can begin with 8 nodes and expand in 4-node increments up to literally hundreds of nodes here. And Weka is basically coming out and saying, we can serve the storage needs of hundreds of nodes of NVIDIA with our storage platform, with millions of IOPS and tons of bandwidth. Basically, we are ready to scale and do some pretty big, pretty awesome AI training. Makes a lot of sense. This is the area that Weka has already been making tremendous wins in HPC and AI. So as I mentioned on the Pure side, you know, basically Weka looked at their offering and they said, what makes sense for us in the AI stack? And where Pure decided that they would focus on RAG and inferencing, Weka is apparently focusing on building these big, awesome, scalable clusters to do AI training. Makes a lot of sense to me.
Not so fast, Stephen, because there's some trouble brewing in this space, as there usually is in a market that has hundreds of billions of dollars of opportunity. And that would be coming from our friends over at Intel, Qualcomm, and Google, because they have put together a consortium called the UXL. And they are seeking to challenge NVIDIA's dominance in the market and do whatever it takes to get a slice of that pie. And I think it's an interesting way that they're going about this. So if you rewind the clock to the 80s, which was, for those of you keeping track out there, 40 years ago. Yeah, don't do that math. You may remember this little company called Microsoft. And they found a way to establish dominance in the market through something that at the time was very novel. We don't care what platform our operating system Windows runs on, as long as it's Intel architecture. Like, you can run it on an IBM PC, you can run it on a Packard Bell, you can run it on anything. And so they effectively said, I'm going to win by decoupling the hardware from the software. Fast forward to today, and one of the ways that NVIDIA is trying to assert their dominance is by making software run more efficiently on their hardware. If you look at what we covered last week with all of their new GPUs and all of their new ways to combine them, you really need to be running things like NVLink in order to be able to get them to communicate effectively. Like, what you're trying to do is go back to the days of the mainframe, where you buy the software from us, you buy the hardware from us, they work best together, and it'll run super duper fast. Now you've got this consortium that is trying to effectively say, we're going to take hardware that runs really well. I mean, that's what Intel and Qualcomm are really, really known for. And we're going to make it so your workloads run really well on our hardware, and you can accomplish this without having to pay the premium that NVIDIA is charging. Now, where are they changing this? They want to make this open source. That's right. They want this to be available for anybody to pull down and run, as long as you're running it on their hardware, so they're still going to get paid. And they've even committed to being able to run NVIDIA workloads on their hardware in the future. Now, of course, there's probably going to have to be some negotiation and some fees that get paid, or some reverse engineering or things like that. But I think it speaks to the fact that when you look at how big NVIDIA's market cap has grown in just the last year, when you see that they are tripling down on everything related to AI, and they're going to try to squeeze that lemon for every drop of juice that it has, naturally, everybody else is going to try to get involved in that. But it's causing companies that historically might have competed a little bit more directly to come together, because they realize that NVIDIA has been slowly assembling this hardware platform to kind of overwhelm all of their opponents. And they got lucky when lightning struck with AI. So in order to beat them, they're going to have to create best of breed. You know, Intel has the chip hardware. Qualcomm has the SoC expertise. Google is the software giant. You have to build that. And that's what they're doing, because UXL has a lot of startups that are waiting to join to be able to add their software identity to what's being run on these architectures. I'm kind of excited, because as we've talked about a number of times here on the rundown, when one company is the dominant player in a market and owns as much of the market share as they possibly can without being busted by the FTC, it gets stagnant really fast. Prices go up, innovation goes down, and nobody cares about it anymore. But when you have a couple of companies or a couple of consortiums who are competing against each other and really driving that innovation, good pricing, good research and feature sets, and customers overall tend to be more happy. So I'm kind of curiously, maybe cautiously optimistic to see, hopefully UXL takes off and can compete against the juggernaut that is NVIDIA right now.
Yeah, I think that you're absolutely right that, you know, no offense, I do not mean my offense by this, but NVIDIA was really lucky that the product that they made was so useful for AI processing. Then they were really smart and really clever by making that product so much better in that market. But overall, I mean, they're still, you know, they still have that GPU heritage enough that the G in GTC, well, what does that stand for again? I think that's something about AI, right? Anyway, you know, the NVIDIA really has that graphics heritage, and the CUDA interface has been one of their key ways of cementing that leadership. Essentially, people have been writing to the CUDA API for a long time as a way to write to NVIDIA's hardware. Well, CUDA was really never meant for that. And one of the things that we saw literally at AI Field Day number one, we had Intel come in and talk about one API. They came in and they talked about it at every AI Field Day event ever since then. One API is really a much better fit for purpose solution to deliver hardware resources to AI processing in general. And the nice thing about one API is that, as it's implied by the name, it could really be one API for almost any kind of hardware, whether that's Intel GPU, Intel accelerators, Intel's, you know, NPUs. You know, I would love to see, you know, how it would work with Gaudi, you know, their dedicated AI chips that they make. But it could also, and it does also work with other people's hardware. Google's right there talking about it. I mean, Google, remember, they've developed their own tensor processors. Qualcomm. Now, Qualcomm's a dark horse here because I think a lot of people, you know, when you hear Qualcomm, you're thinking, oh, mobile phone processors, maybe networking processors. But Qualcomm is really putting a ton of effort into becoming another NVIDIA competitor here with tensor processors. And they've been doing a lot of work on that. I think that they could indeed emerge as another challenger to NVIDIA, along with AMD, along with ARM, along with certainly Intel. And all of that needs a standard interface in order to basically break the stranglehold of NVIDIA / CUDA. That interface is going to be one API. It looks to me. And so for me, that's really the message here is that basically we have a consortium pushing an alternative software interface. Back to your example, Tom, I think you're dead on there. It's as if, you know, we've got the Windows API that was so dominant in the 90s. And then somebody came along and said, well, you know, we could have an alternative software environment. You know, we've got this LAMP stack, you know, we've got this Linux stack that we can run web applications on. And that kind of busted up that Wintel dominance in computing. That's what's the attempt here. And I think that that's very, very smart. Now, there's one more story that I want to cover before we finish, and that is Oracle announcing a sovereign cloud. As I talked about earlier, this whole idea of fit for purpose makes a lot of sense for me. Companies need to take a cold, hard look at what is it that we have and how is this going to be valuable to customers, and then figure out a solution based on that. And that's really what we've got Oracle doing here. They have a wonderful offering, sovereign cloud offering in multiple locations around the world. In fact, I think that last I checked, they were in 66 cloud regions in 26 countries. And the cool thing is that Oracle has built these things to truly be native to that soil, that sovereignty, from a data sovereignty perspective. And of course, they've had to, because that's Oracle's heritage. They understand data. They understand data sovereignty. This is very sensitive in many countries. I used to work for a Swiss bank. Data sovereignty was incredibly important. It's incredibly important in the EU. It's incredibly important in the United States, in China, in the Five Eyes countries, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Companies don't want their stuff going out. Not only that, but companies are increasingly specifying that you have to use a sovereign AI in their territory. So, for example, there's word that Apple is going to be licensing, I think, Baidu's LLM on iPhone. Same discussion about Apple licensing another LLM in another region that's been rumored. Why are they doing that? It's not because they don't want, you know, they want to do that. It's because they have to do that because you have to use sovereign LLMs. Well, the same is true of enterprise applications. The same is true in the cloud. And Oracle is essentially positioning itself as a way to answer that. So companies will be able to say, yes, your data is maintained in the geographic area that you need it to be. You know, not only that, but the AI is also contained in that area. We're not allowing data to escape. You know, we're not allowing privacy laws to be breached, et cetera. So again, it makes a lot of sense. And I really think that Oracle's doing a great thing here with their sovereign cloud.
Stephen, before we go, I had one little thing I wanted to bring up that's been making the news rounds this week. Microsoft employee Dave Plummer remarked that it's been 30 years since he migrated the format UI from Windows 95 to Windows NT. He spent an entire afternoon sketching it out before he programmed it in Visual C++ 2.0 and said, this will just work until we can come up with a more elegant solution that allows me to change the cluster size. So if you ever wondered why you can't format a FAT32 disk bigger than 32 gigabytes or why the format UI in Windows 11 looks so janky, remember that there's nothing more permanent than a temporary solution. But what's not temporary is all of the great events that we have coming up on our Tech Field Day calendar. The first one of them is going to be happening April 10th and 11th. It's going to be Security Field Day 11. We are very excited to be talking to companies like Ariaka, Index Engines, Palo Alto Networks, and Zerto. And we have a wonderful lineup of delegates that will be joining us. You can always go to techfieldday.com to find more information about who will be presenting as well as who will be attending. And then about a month later, we're going to be hearing from a great group of companies that are focused on the mobility and wireless space, including brand new announcements. Celona will be joining us there. They are a fan favorite of our delegates. They actually launched at Mobility Field Day, and we are thrilled to be getting a catch up with them. They're going to be joined by a lot of other companies, you know, heavyweights in the industry that you probably recognize. Again, techfieldday.com is where you find more information about that. And then, Stephen, you've got something coming up right after that that people want to know about.
Absolutely. We're doing our first ever App Dev Field Day. Now, we've done Cloud Field Day for a long time. And cloud, well, the C word refers to a lot of things now, all the way from the data center to public cloud to microservices and modern applications. So we decided to come up with an event focused on the latter, focused on modern applications, web scale applications, microservices. We decided to call it App Dev Field Day because we didn't really want to only focus it on DevOps, but we really wanted to differentiate it from all of the IT infrastructure content, hybrid cloud infrastructure that we've got at Cloud Field Day. So App Dev Field Day is coming. We're going to have a great group of delegates and companies presenting. The event is co-hosted by my good friend, Paul Nashawaty, who leads the modern application practice at Futurum. And I think that it's going to be great. Right after that, June 11th to 13th, we have the annual 6.5 Summit. Now, this is a huge event. They've announced that the keynote speaker is going to be Bill McDermott from ServiceNow, who is an industry legend. Check out more at the 6.5summit.com to learn a little bit more about that.
And be sure that you're checking techfieldday.com for more information about upcoming events, because we're going to be adding several of them very soon. We have a lot of things coming up this summer that you're not going to want to miss out on. And that should hopefully be just enough of a tease to get you to subscribe to all the cool stuff happening. But we're very glad that you're subscribed to what we're doing here at the Gestalt IT Rundown. Remember, we publish an episode every Wednesday, and we are thrilled to be bringing you the news of the week, the big announcements, the little fun things that happen, whatever it is. You can always catch it on your favorite YouTube application, which probably is the YouTube application. Just look for Gestalt IT Video. Or if you want to listen to us as a podcast, you can find us in your favorite podcatcher, of which there are more than one. But, you know, we love to get your feedback and hear what you have to say. We love that we are the primary news source for a lot of folks because, you know, we cover what's important. We get right to the heart of the matter and we make it a little bit fun. we will be back next Wednesday with another great episode where we will have, you know, maybe more news stories about NVIDIA GTC, because I'm sure there probably will be a few, along with several other things that were happening during the week. But until then, for Stephen Foskett, Tom Hollingsworth, for Corey Dierig, our producer, and all of the great people here at Gestalt IT, take care of yourself. Enjoy the springtime, unless you're in one of those places where it's still cold. And we will see you in April.